Welcome to this episode of the Pharmaceutical Executive Podcast. I'm Miranda Schmalfus, an editor with Pharmaceutical Executive. On this week's episode, I'm thrilled to be able to talk to Dr. Lawrence B. Werland, MD, FACOG of HRC Fertility. You might recognize Dr. Werland from his HopeCore videos on TikTok. His handle is at md.lawrence.werland. On this week's episode of the podcast, Dr. Werland and I discuss the biggest misconceptions about fertility on social media and how he works to correct the spread of misinformation, ethical considerations of using social media to share personal and professional experiences, especially in a field so sensitive as fertility, new radiological techniques that are revolutionizing the diagnosis of conditions like endometriosis, and so much more. So without further ado, Dr. Werland, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Miranda, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is a field I love.
What are the biggest misconceptions about fertility that you see circulating on social media? That's a really big topic that we're kind of dealing with at PharmExec right now. And how do you work to correct those misconceptions and the spread of misinformation?
It's not an easy question to answer, Miranda. There are a lot of things that are packed in into that comment. But let me start out by saying, number one, I think that social media can be very, very beneficial in that it can impart educational approach to fertility and fertility issues. On the flip side, you also know that there are many people who get on the social media on TikTok, on Instagram, on whatever it may be, and tell stories that may or may not be factual. So part of the problem that we deal with is that many times patients that we see come to us with questions that they've heard on TikTok or on Instagram or on Facebook or some social media aspect and are confused about what it really means. So I think that the critical thing for us and the thing that I typically do for me is two things. Number one, when I meet with the patients, I try to give them an overview of what goes on when they get evaluated by a fertility specialist. And I try and explain to them what happens to them, what their evaluation is, what that evaluation means, and what their ultimate likelihood for success is depending on what they do. The second thing I try to do is every Wednesday at about 12:15, I do a TikTok, which is called Wednesdays with the World. And when I do that TikTok, I effectively will pick a topic and will review that topic with people who are involved on the TikTok. And then I open it up to questions. And maybe once a month, people have questions constantly. So once a month, I will actually do that Wednesdays with the World and only go through questions that people ask and try and answer them and give them the best answer that I can. I think the most important thing that I try to have patients take away from this is that one, it's educational. Two, it's what I think. Remember, medicine is definitely a science, but reproductive medicine is also an art, and how people do things can be different. So my way of doing things is certainly my way of doing things, but it doesn't mean that it's the only way. There are other ways that you may approach a similar problem. It doesn't mean they're right or wrong. It just means that there are other ways to do things. And I think it's important that when people go to these social media scenarios, that they take away from it whatever it is they do. And then when they talk to their fertility physician, they can, you know, give them the pros and cons about what they ask. So I think that's how hopefully I would try to approach it.
I think it's important that it's great because social media gives the opportunity to kind of share experience and kind of share different pathways of treatment, but it's certainly important to remember to get that final information from an ethical source or trusted source, somebody that is actually a doctor, not somebody that's just in a Facebook comment section.
Absolutely. That's very key because although there are a lot of good things that are out there in social media, there are a lot of things that are just contrary to what is reality.
Absolutely. So that kind of brings us naturally to my next question. What are the ethical considerations of using social media to share personal and professional experiences, especially in a field as sensitive as fertility?
The important factors that you have to take into account is that when I, for example, utilize social media, I tell the patients or the people who are listening right up front that these are my opinions, these are my thoughts, this is how I would manage a specific case. And again, medicine is an art, and there are multiple ways to do things. And it's important to take into account that there are many ways that you can address a certain situation. And each doctor may be different, and you have to take that into account. So that's really the first thing I think that's important. And I tell the patients that when I do this. I think the other thing that's critical is that just because I say that doesn't mean that patients, will believe that. They may think that, well, this is the only way to do it, and I need to do it that way. And that's not always the case. The reality is that there are different ways of approaching problems, and really what your physician outlines for you hopefully is the best approach that you can do. But your options, of course, are that if you don't feel it's the best, you can always seek another opinion. And many times social media offers that second opinion type situation. With respect to anonymity, I think that it is important for people to observe their own anonymity because otherwise it sets up problems that could occur for them. It's not an unusual thing for a patient to say, I am a 32-year-old woman. I've been trying to get pregnant for X amount of years. I've been unsuccessful. I've done a number of procedures. That's fine. But I certainly would, encourage them to not necessarily use their name, necessarily use the facility that they're working with. I would keep it as broad as possible so as not to incur any problems with respect to anonymity. And with HIPAA violations, it's very important to keep patient confidentiality at the peak.
Absolutely. And patient privacy is something that we've had countless conversations on. It's one of the biggest things that is a concern, especially with things like AI. And that's just like a new technology that's emerging. But speaking of new technologies, how are new radiological techniques revolutionizing the diagnosis of conditions like endometriosis? And what impact will this have on patient outcomes?
Well, that's a great question. So, just to give your listeners a picture, endometriosis, the normal lining of the uterine cavity is endometrium. And what typically happens is when you get your period, that endometrial tissue breaks down and you pass it through the cervix and out through the vagina. However, if your fallopian tubes are open, which we hope that they are, then the likelihood is that you probably have a menstrual fluid that goes out through your tubes as well. So when you look at endometriosis, the definition is you see endometrial tissue in places other than inside the uterus. And the two most common places that you end up seeing it are on the ovary and in the bottom of the pelvis. And it makes sense to you why 80% of the disease is found there. And part of the reason for that is the fallopian tube sits right on top of the ovary. So if you have retrograde menstruation, meaning the fluid is coming out through the tube, you could picture that it might land on the ovary. And secondly, you could picture that it would be in the bottom of the pelvis in the cul-de-sac because gravity would pull that fluid down there. And in the right environment, in the right milieu, whatever that may be for that particular patient, that tissue will stick and then form endometriosis. So that tissue can bleed just like you bleed when you have your period. It goes through the same hormonal changes. And so that when you're having a period, the tissue that's in other places can bleed as well. That's how, for example, you'll get these endometriotic cysts in your ovary. Effectively, They're just little blind pockets of old blood, with the lining of that cyst being endometrium. And so it's a significant factor. Now, the gold standard always was making the diagnosis by laparoscopy. Laparoscopy is a surgical procedure where the patient is asleep and you go, you put a scope through her belly button, and you're able to look at the pelvic organs. So it actually serves two purposes. One, it's diagnostic in that you can look and see if there's a problem there, like endometriosis, scar tissue, adhesions, whatever it may be. And then secondly, it can be therapeutic in that you can treat the disease at the time. If there are adhesions, you can lyse those adhesions. If there's endometriosis, you could use a laser or cautery to ablate or remove the tissue. So it's beneficial, and it's always been the gold standard to make the diagnosis. Previously, if you saw things on ultrasound, like an echogenic cyst in the ovary, meaning it had junk in there, like old blood, for example, you might say, well, there's a good likelihood that this is endo. But you can't say it, definitely that that's the case. But now things are truly changing. And there are now more radiographic indications of what endo really looks like. Ultrasound techniques are so dramatically better that you can use those to make better definitions without doing laparoscopy. And also, things like MRIs have proven to be much more beneficial. So the tide is changing. I think, honestly speaking, the ultimate gold standard will always probably be laparoscopy because it serves those two purposes in that one, it's diagnostic, and two, it can be therapeutic. But certainly the radiological ultrasound, MRI, have really improved the ability to non-surgically make the diagnosis.
I've had a lot of conversations about the earlier that you're able to identify something, the easier it is to treat. The sooner you get in there, the better chance it is to treat something. So I'm sure that that also helps shorten that window of trying to identify what it is.
I absolutely agree with you. And that is the key, exactly what you just said, Miranda. The earlier that you make a diagnosis and the earlier that you treat it, the better the outcome.
So, how can advancements in technology and data analysis lead to more personalized fertility treatments? We've had a lot of conversations again, personalized medicine. And you were saying that medicine is an art, so fertility, very personalized journey. So, curious on your thoughts there.
Well, I tell this to my patients as well. All 32-year-old women aren't the same. All 40-year-old women aren't the same. Everybody is different. So, what is it that I need to help individualize your potential care? So, there's a workup that you do that helps you to get some basic information that gives you some leeway into how you make appropriate protocols for that individual patient. And it's really the workup that's actually the most important. And when we evaluate the couple, we do it as a couple. So, for example, with respect to the male, we'll always look at a sperm analysis. We'll look to see that he has sperm, that they move appropriately, that they look normal, that there are no signs of infection, poor count, poor motility, poor shape, infection all inhibit sperm's ability to penetrate an egg. So, it's important to know that beforehand, so that if you need to get therapy for that, you can. With respect to the woman, we evaluate them. Women are born with all their eggs. They're born with about 2 million eggs. And by the time they start their first period, they have about 400,000 eggs left. So from age zero to your first period, 80% of your eggs are gone. That process goes on every single month. The eggs that you have sit in these little structures, which are called follicles. And you have two kinds of follicles that exist. One group are called antral follicles. Those are the follicles that have the potential to develop in that given month. And the other group of follicles that you have are called primordial follicles, which are those that are in your reserve or in your gas tank. So every month you call up some number of antral follicles. Whatever number that is yours. It'll be different than your sister, different than your best friend. It is whatever it is for you. If you don't take any fertility meds, you only make one dominant follicle. That dominant follicle sends out inhibitors and prevents the other follicles from developing. But at the end of that month, if you're not pregnant, all of those follicles that had the potential to develop are gone. So when we do a process like IVF or fertility preservation, where we're going to freeze your eggs, we override that dominant follicle mechanism and try and call up everything that's available in that particular cycle. So typically, we have patients come in on day two or three of their cycle, day one being the first day of red blood flow, and we look at some hormone testing. We look at estradiol, we look at FSH, and we look at LH because those three hormones correlate well with their antral count. And they're the only three, by the way, that have to be done on a specific day. Then there are a number of other hormones that we look at that are not cycle day specific, meaning you can do it any day of the cycle. The most important one is called AMH. AMH stands for anti-Müllerian hormone. That's the hormone that tells me about your reserve. Doesn't tell me that you have 100,000 eggs or 50 eggs or 5 eggs. It's a lab value. And depending on your age group, that lab value will be somewhere between 0.16 and maybe 13 at the highest. You'll fall somewhere in that range. The closer you fall to that 0.16, the fewer the eggs you have in reserve. So that's important for me to know. We also will look at your thyroid function. The most common medical hormone abnormality that occurs in young people of reproductive age is low thyroid function. And the most common reason why it occurs is that you make antibodies or hostilities to your thyroid. It's called autoimmune thyroiditis or Hashimoto's disease. And then we also look at a hormone called prolactin. Prolactin is a hormone that comes from your pituitary gland, which sits right back up here from your nose, and it stimulates your breasts to make milk. So women, of course, who are pregnant will have very high levels of prolactin, but in the non-pregnant state, it should be normal. But there are conditions where it could be elevated and it can interfere with normal ovulatory function. The most common other entity that's associated with that is actually low thyroid function, which is why we do those together. And then the final one we look at is vitamin D. Vitamin D is important in egg development, embryo development, and pregnancy. You would think to yourself that living in Southern California, where 300 days a year the sun is out, and if you go out for half an hour a day and get exposed to UV light, that should activate the vitamin D in your skin. But I can tell you that about 85% of the people I see have low vitamin D. They wear sunblock, they wear long sleeves, they wear jeans, they don't go out, whatever the case may be, vitamin D is a factor. So we look at those things to help us get a scenario where we are. And the other thing that I think is important to look at are carrier screens. Carrier screens are screening bloods that look to see if you and your partner share any recessive traits. First of all, we all carry certain recessive things just because of heredity, right? It's just a fact. The critical thing is that you don't share something with your partner. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you were a carrier for non-syndromic hearing loss, where you hear me fine, you don't have the disease, but you're a carrier for it. Now you test your partner and you find out that your partner is also a carrier. So neither of you have the disease, you're both carriers. But now if you make a baby, there's a 25% risk that that baby will be deaf. You would want to know that certainly before you even tried to get pregnant. Certainly, if you were trying to get pregnant on your own, you'd want to be prepared for, if something like that should occur. But more importantly, if you were trying to get pregnant, you could then use IVF and use genetic testing to test for that specific abnormality and prevent a hereditary disease from occurring. So you try and put all of these things together and get information on that couple so that you can give them the best protocol for them and the best opportunities for them to achieve a successful pregnancy. I think that that with the advent of AI, first of all, let me just say that being with a physician, dealing with your physician, interacting with your physician will always be the primary thing that you need to do. Being able to interact and speak to your physician and deal with them directly will always be the most important thing that you can do. But with technology like AI coming through, there can be some significant benefits to it. And for example, let's say a patient presents with certain clinical factors that you need to know. Typically, when you think about those things, you do it in your own mind where you think about, well, if this occurred, then I'm expecting that I would see this, and you try and deal with that. With AI, you can take those symptoms, put them into an algorithm, and they will search not only what you know, but they will search the literature, they will search, other things that are available that you may not have, and give you a much better and a much more enhanced differential diagnosis than you would have started out with. And also may give you information about what they think may be better treatments. You, as the physician and the patient, make the ultimate decisions, but having as much information as you can get to make those decisions is always beneficial.
Talking about like the recessive genes brings me right back to high school biology and doing Punnett squares because I have blonde hair and blue eyes, so I know two recessive genes right there. But that's more of like the fun stuff. That's not, unfortunately, talking about things like, possibly being deaf.
Well,
But
it's interesting because, each one of your chromosomes carries 1,000 genes. So your genome, or really who you are, is made up of about 25,000 genes. So when we do the carrier screen, we don't look at all 25,000 genes, by the way, but we look at the 400 to 500 most common abnormalities that do occur, and we see whether or not there's any sharing that goes on.
that's such important information to have, certainly.
Yeah.
So, what are the most exciting developments in fertility treatment that you anticipate in the next few years?
Well, again, as you said, the radiological procedures, improving the ability of diagnosing certain diseases before you really have to do a surgical procedure, whereas maybe the surgical procedure was the only way to make the diagnosis, that will be beneficial. That will occur. When you look at genetic testing of embryos, although still obviously an experimental procedure that it is, it will continue to improve. Right now, when we do genetic testing, first of all, you can look at whether or not the embryo has normal chromosomes, and you can also know its gender as well. And that's important. And then the other thing that you can also know is that if there's a specific disease entity that the couple share, meaning they don't have it, but they have the recessive trait, then you can look for that in the embryo as well and prevent a hereditary disease from occurring. Now, hopefully, as time goes on, you're going to be able to potentially know whether an embryo, what its risk is for specific things. So right now, when you do what's called PGTM or pre-implantation genetic testing for monogenetic diseases, you're looking at diseases that are caused by a single gene, like cystic fibrosis, like retinitis pigmentosa, whatever it may be, Huntington's disease, things like that, which are clearly factors that you don't want to be able to transmit, right? You don't want to pass those on. But there are other diseases like hypertension, like diabetes, like heart disease that are also genetically involved but are not caused by a single gene. They may be caused by a cluster of genes or certain abnormalities in specific genes. So now I think the technology will occur whereby you're able to now look at an embryo and say, well, potentially this embryo, although genetically it looks normal and has normal chromosomes, this embryo is at greater risk for developing diabetes or developing hypertension or developing heart disease, which will be important. So a couple may have X number of normal embryos, chromosomally normal embryos, but may be able to choose which embryo will have the least likelihood of having those diseases, which would be very important. And hopefully the technology will improve so that we're able to do that. And then there are other things that may be done that are certainly being done now on an experimental basis, like CRISPR, where they actually are able to resect part of gene abnormalities and remove them from developing tissue. It's not yet approved for things in humans, but will certainly have a better likelihood in the future of being available.
Great. So last question, and an important one because always accessibility and affordability, big topic and big theme from this year, and certainly always, I think, in this industry that we're in. How can we make advanced fertility treatments more accessible and affordable to a wider range of patients?
That's a great question. Well, in California, they're working very hard to do that, as I'm sure you know. They have passed a bill, the specifics of which we're not 100% clear about, but offering insurance coverage for fertility care, which is very important. It's one thing to offer it in an insurance versus mandating it to occur. And the mandate is now available in California, or will become available. And that really allows more people to have the ability to utilize fertility care. Secondly, there are many companies like Apple, Amazon, different large companies that offer their employees benefits like fertility preservation, where they have these young people who are in these jobs who may not be ready to have a family yet, who may not even have a partner, but enjoy, doing what they're doing. They're looking at their profession, and they're offering them the ability to do fertility preservation, which means freezing their eggs at a young age. And as we said, as you age, the genetic material within those eggs breaks down, they become less viable, less functional, less likely to be successful. So here you're offering them something where they can freeze it in their 20s or, in their early 30s and may not ever need to use them. But if they did, when they use them, they will be the age at what it was when they froze them, which is phenomenal. And many of the large companies in the country are offering that now to their group. And the final thing I think that's important is this has been obviously a very tumultuous year for our field, many things happening politically. And I think one of the most important things that you can do as the individual is to continue to contact your legislators and encourage them to continue to fight for your reproductive rights, because those are your rights, your ability to choose to get pregnant without someone else telling you what to do. It's important without government interference with that. So you need to take the reins as the individual and continue to promote that. So I think those are key things.
Absolutely. You have to advocate for yourself in the
Absolutely.
patient room and out too. Absolutely.
Absolutely. You are the individual, and it should be your choice as to what you do, not some government agency telling you what to do.
Totally agree. Dr. Werlin, I have enjoyed our conversation so much today, and I know that our listeners and our viewers are going to get a lot out of this.
Thank you, Miranda, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is a field I love, and helping people to successfully achieve a pregnancy and have their ultimate goal of a family is really the most exciting thing that we can do.
I love it. I love how passionate you are. And I like I said, I'm a follower, and I encourage everybody else to follow you because I love my Wednesdays with Worrell and and my Hope Core videos. So I'm looking forward to more.
Thank you, Miranda. It was great seeing you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Farm Exec Podcast, where we take you behind the headlines to provide expert tips from industry leaders. Remember, you can always find us on the web at farmexec.com, on Twitter at farmexec, and on Instagram at farmexecutive. The views on this podcast do not reflect those of MJH Farm Exec's parent company or our advertisers. For editorial questions or to get in touch with our editors, please email us at farmexec@mjhlifesciences.com. And for sponsorship opportunities, please go to farmexec.com/advertise. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next time.